Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame. On this, part two of the Jimmy Helms interview, enjoy the ride which has been a long, long road to success, the London Beat hit I've Been Thinking About You, and the video shoot where we first met, and the double-decker bus party that neither of us can remember that well. But first, back to the musical Hair, which was about youth, rebellion and love, and satirised racism.
How did the attention of that role then help your further musical music career?
Good question. There was a scene in Hair where it's a very symbolic scene. There's a lot of the show was symbolic scene where the American flag is placed on the floor of the stage, on the ground. And this is a big no-no in American society. You don't do that. We had the show was shut down for, I think, 2 weeks because of this move. The local councilors and politicians were up in arms saying, you could go to jail, you could go to prison for doing this. We're going to shut the show down and decide what's going to happen at that point. Well, it was a mixed blessing because I got a chance to do television in New York. There was a nationwide program called The Merv Griffin Show, which asked me to come back because I'd done this show quite a few times before. I came back on the Merv Griffin Show and talked about this incident in Boston that most other cities had overcome with their local politicians, and it wasn't a problem anymore. But Boston, being the conservative kind of town that it was, and in many ways still is, this issue of the flag on the floor was a big deal. So I went on the Merv Griffin Show, sang a couple of songs, went back again and again and again, and it started to give me more and more profile in America because this was a liftoff. And so, as I say, it was a mixed blessing in that sense of the word.
So how did that turn into sort of suddenly having the UK on your radar? Because if the 60s were, you know, this whole process that you went through, and then a sort of the bit of the catapult at the end because of Hair, and then came a decade where the UK sort of became more important. So how did that turn into actual record, and then how did that turn into coming to the UK?
Okay, my time in Hair was coming to an end. I had, as I say, this exposure at my fingertips with the Merv Griffin Show and a couple of other television shows in New York City. I went to New York again to work in the venues and gig around Manhattan. In that point in time, I hooked up and we formed a band. It was originally formed in Boston, and we were working on the East Side in Manhattan for Yonks. People would come in to see us, and we got made a lot of progress from this venue that we were working in. One of the things that happened there was, I think a record promoter, somebody I was speaking to in between our shows in this venue, said to me, you know, there's an opportunity you may be interested in to go and do represent the U.S. in a song contest happening in Athens. So thought about it, spoke to the band, said, I'll go and do this thing. We'll pick up where we left off later on. You know, we each had our opportunities, and we chased down our opportunities, such as life. So I went to Athens. The long and short of that is that I met Les Reed. Les Reed was one of the judges on the festival, on this Athens Song Festival. And of course, Les had written all of the big hits for Tom Jones. Les Reed approached me after the festival was finished and said, come to London. I think I may have some songs for you. Or if I don't, I know somebody who does. And I think we can find, if you're up to it, we can find some common ground here and maybe get some recording done. Okay. So I finished. See how life is like watching a tennis match. The opportunities flying back and forth, and the ones that you're able to grasp as they fly past you are the ones that will either move you on or not. So I made the decision, and it turned out to be a good one, to save my pennies, get on the first flight I could with my saved pennies, and get to London. There, I met, through Les Reed, I met John Worth. And bless him, he was a wonderful man. He had a spirit like Barry Gordy or somebody, you know. That's where he was in his mind. I think he wanted that kind of degree of, sure, recognition, but he wanted to achieve that kind of stature in the music business where, yeah, he wanted to produce, write songs and so forth. And it was the right person for me to meet in the right place at the right time. So it was one of those occasions. John Worth was a pivotal point in my career.
He'd written songs for Marty Wilde, for Adam Faith. I mean, he'd written by the time he wrote for you, he'd written for a number of very, very, very well-known stars of that era. Can you remember the first time you heard, and I'm not going to say the name of the track because I want you to say it, that you heard that track, you know, that or you saw the music, or I don't know how it would have worked. Would he have played it to you and said, this is a song I want you to sing?
If we're thinking about going to make you an offer you can't refuse, is that the one?
That's it.
Yeah, okay. The film, The Godfather, was big news. Of course, it was a big deal everywhere, globally. John Worth had seen the film. I hadn't seen it yet. And so when he brought this idea to me, it was like, okay, you know, the vibe. He had seen the film, and this line kept sticking in his mind, I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse. And we met the first time about this idea at at the recording company, which turned out to be Fly Records, Cube Records, and we routined this song with a new face, a new guy named Mike Moran. Mike Moran went on and did big work with Freddie Mercury, Barcelona, all of that, amongst his other successes. He was involved with, heavily involved with Dave Clark's musical Time in the West End of London. So we routined the song and routined it and kicked it around. And it was just kind of nice melody, but not really, there was no peaks and valleys. There was not enough. You were speaking about it before. It had that all of that business, the melody down in the low range of my voice. But I'm thinking, well, where can it go to? Where's the ladder up, you know? And so Mike and I were sitting around the piano one day, and I came up with that falsetto bit and the little monologue after the chorus. Did you ever sit waiting, hoping, da ba 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 ba? And we molded this song out of a phrase, gonna make you an offer you can't refuse, but turning it into a love song. And finally, finally, it became the song that people heard on the radio, and the rest is history.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, for me, I remember when that came out in the 70s. I would have been a teenager back then, and for me, it was that the beauty of the vocals on that song, which just sort of, I don't know, they shot up into the stratosphere, didn't they? They were just amazing. And it was a beautiful song. And as you say, it was a phrase that came from The Godfather, but it was an unexpected twist that also, I think, helped propel it, because people knew that phrase, but then they heard it as a love song, as you said. So in some way, you turned it into something very special.
It was one of those moments, and there have been a few, knock wood, and thankfully, a few moments when I can look at that incident and say, it was an inspired moment. I say inspired from whichever way you want to look at it. It was inspired that John Worth came up with that phrase, came up with that melody. It was inspired that we three, Mike Moran, John and I, got together in the first place and came up with something that held water well enough that this far along afterwards, I can look at that and say, yeah, I'm proud of that moment. So thankfully, the gods were smiling.
After that, and it seems a real shame that in a way, you weren't able to capitalize on that enormous success of that song to have, you know, a further string of hits. And you went into a period of being a session musician, of working with other acts for quite a while. And I want to sort of bring this up to more about the time that we met before. So bringing it up further. And then suddenly, and I don't know how it came about because my memory's completely gone on this one, but you formed a band called London Beat with these three other guys. Yeah. So how did that actually come about, and what were your feelings about the band at the beginning? Did you have real positive feelings about it working, or did you feel like, oh, I wonder, you know, is this me trying again, and here we go again, will this work? Do you know what I mean? Because you've been through such a lot of that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, once again, to paint the picture of where I was after Gonna Make You an Offer You Can't Refuse, I wanted to continue as a solo artist. That was my endeavor. That's what I wanted to be. And I knew in order to do that, I had to have songs. I did not have at that point in time my own, I didn't have enough confidence in my own songwriting or a mutual confidence, if you will, with the record company to say, I've got this song and that song and that song as a follow-up to Gonna Make You an Offer, or to maybe co-write something with John Worth, for example. None of that really came to be. None of it materialized quickly enough to sustain the success that we had with Make You an Offer, for example. So there I was, kind of back in the kind of hinterland, if you will, of what's going to happen next. What do I do now? I became a bit disillusioned by the atmosphere, the relationship with the record company that I was dealing with. And at that point, I went back to the U.S. I had family by that time, and I went back to the U.S., enrolled in a local community college, started taking some courses in computer programming and so forth to try and just get a new take on where I was. When I speak of computer programming, I was looking for some kind of programming that would, now there's loads of it. You've got all of these applications by which you can just load up in your home studio and make music on your own. You know, if I'd had something at my fingertips at that point in time, it may be that London Beat Mate would not have happened. But there you are. So after a time in the US, I started to look at my situation. I was getting fed up with computer programming. It was not what I wanted to be. I'm looking at the news and I see, bing, here's a band called Eurythmics who are on the front, headline news on the Wall Street Journal about the return of the British music invasion to America, blah, blah, blah. That was the essence of this article. And I'm thinking, okay, so things are cooking back in the UK again, and it may be a time for me to get back there and get something done, because it's music that I want to be. I've never denied that fact. We sold house in Plymouth, Massachusetts, half an hour from Boston, and arrived back in the UK, bang, with nothing but a dream, empty pockets and a dream, if you will. I worked in computer programming to try and sort of, keep body and soul together whilst I got back into doing some session work, whatever it took to get connected back in the music scene in the UK. Long story short, Steve, a couple of friends that I had known prior to moving back to Boston had been working with Paul Young. They were out on tour with Paul Young, and they were trying to get me to go out on tour with Paul Young. But as I say, and I underline, now I don't want to be a BV singer. I don't want to be a background singer. I want to be a part of something that is ours, mine or ours. If you guys are interested in getting together, maybe we can write some songs. So what happens next? These two guys that I'm speaking of, George Chandler and Jimmy Chambers, and I were doing this television thing. I think it was The Wire, The Wired show, which came from Newcastle. We trained up to Newcastle, trained back home after it, you know.
Was that The Tube? The Tube.
Yeah, The Tube. Thank you. Yeah. It was The Tube. Thank you for the correction. It was not The Wire, it's The Tube. And so I ride back home. My phone rings minutes after I'm in the house. And this person is saying, hey, I just saw you guys on Tube, and we want to know if you're interested in getting together and writing some songs. That person was Willie M. and so, wow, you know, you think, well, okay, let's listen to it and see if there's anything in it. We met George, Jimmy, and I with Willie M the following night and in London, and the seeds were sown for London Beat from that meeting. And so it's amazing how, I don't know, you call it what you want, I call it some kind of...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A blessing that we were able to be in that close proximity with each other. As I say, I just arrived back from Boston shortly before this, and here we are in a situation. I'm looking at this situation myself, and I'm thinking, is this what I want to be? We'll have to find out. Don't make any decisions until you've gone through the process and found out, satisfied yourself as to whether or not there's something in it worth pursuing. And it turned out that there was something pursuable in that.
Hey, y'all, it's your girl, Keke Palmer. I'm proud to introduce to you my new podcast, Baby, This is Keke Palmer, exclusively on Amazon Music. I'm putting my friends, family, and some of the hottest experts in the hot seat to ask them the questions that have been burning on my mind. What would former child stars be if they weren't actors? Is OnlyFans only bad? I want to know, so I asked my mama about it. These are the questions that keep me up at night, and I'm letting y'all all in on it. Come kick it with me and my weekly guests as we go down the rabbit hole and dive deep into my mind together. Listen to Baby, This is Keke Palmer, exclusively on Amazon Music.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Now, with the biggest hit, I've Been Thinking About You, which was a number one on the Billboard charts in America. I think it was number two in Britain. It was just all over the place, just this massive, massive hit. But I think it came off the second album. So that, yes, and the first did. Album wasn't an immediate success, but the second album was. And I want to go back to a point where we met, because you were filming the video to I've Been Thinking About You. You may not even remember I was there, but I was. I remember it clearly because I loved it. And I was so shocked because there was this surprise, in a sense, and it felt like this video had to be done very quickly because the success of the song was so quick. And you were all taken by surprise, and you were all in this. There was this wonderful energy to it that day, and there was this wonderful feeling about it because it was such a beautiful, successful moment. And it felt like, you know, particularly for you, and I think for George and the other Jimmy, that it had taken a long, long time to get here. It had taken a long, long time to have this world success. How was that for you? And did it come as a surprise, or did you actually believe the moment you recorded it, we have something?
Well, we believed we had a song that yes, we had something with some strong possibilities as a single, follow-up single too. If I backtrack for a second, my favorite song of all the London Beat material we've ever done was 9 a.m. That song for me is represents something that is close to my heart and will remain so. That said, we got a lot of industry positive response from 9 a.m. And I think a lot of that flowed into what happened next. We went back when that first album, Speak, was finishing up, you know, and we'd gotten as much mileage out of it as we could. Time to do a second album. And we were speaking with the record company, and they're saying, you know, you need to come more kind of into some middle ground that's radio friendly and blah, blah, blah. All of that business that record companies rightfully, I guess, put to their artists. Some of it's questionable in hindsight, but there you are. We went back in and started the second album with a view to, trying to come more mainstream, if you will, and get something that had more radio friendliness about it. I've Been Thinking About You happened. It was a surprise. it was a case of everybody standing up to the microphone, singing their bit of what they thought this track could sound like. Jimmy Chambers stood up to the microphone and sang almost top to bottom what we now know as that song, I've Been Thinking About You. And we looked at each other all and we thought, yeah, maybe we got something here. Let's pursue this. We finished what we thought was the best demo we could of I've Been Thinking About You, sent it back to BMG, and they listened to it and said, try again. Try and see if you can push this idea into something more, whatever. What it sounded like to us was the record company was looking for us to write our first swimming pool, if you will. Write your first mansion off this song, you know? And it's a mistake because you're reaching for something that is not in your heart and not in your soul and so forth. So long story, maybe short as possible, we pursued the original idea of I've Been Thinking About You, pushed it around, and came back time and time again after maybe 50, 60 tries, came back to the original idea. We embellished the mix as much as we could, sent it back to the record company, and they said, okay, this is it. Basically the same. It's like if it's like somebody served you a meal and you say, no, send it back to the kitchen. The kitchen sends it back, and they put a couple more lettuce leaves on the plate or something.
You know what it's like, Jimmy. It's like what William Goldman said about the film industry. No one knows anything.
So. It's true. It's so true. No business is that more true than in the music business. It is what it is. And in hindsight, you know, it's all, you can put it down to a lesson learned here and there. But in the final analysis, it's a lesson about the artist trusting their own integrity, trusting their own instincts. And because you're always going to come back to those anyway. If you don't come back to those in the final analysis, you're going to be sorry that you didn't, because you'll ended up maybe selling your soul in some way that you didn't want to do. So, yeah.
Beautifully. Just go back to something you mentioned, because it's made me curious. This 9 a.m., I mean, that was much more of a soulful song. What was it about? What was close to you about that song? Can you tell me? Because you said it was very personal.
It happened, maybe, it was probably the second song, that second song idea that we worked on. And the whole situation under which 9 a.m. came to be was that William, Jimmy, George, and I had met, I think maybe the second time we met ever. To backtrack to the story that I told you about how we met in the first place with William, we were kicking around this thing, and Willie handed me a cassette phone, a little really worn out cassette, and he said, take this home, there's a couple of those scratchy ideas on here that maybe we can look at next time, if we meet our next time. So I took it home, shoved it into the cassette player, and this scratchy little thing was coming back at me off the cassette, which was the basis of the chord structure, excuse me, and the atmosphere, if you will, that became 9 a.m. I got on the phone, rang Willie, and said, if you got anything you can bring tomorrow to move this idea on structurally, chord wise, whatever, bring it, because I think maybe there's something here. I said to him, I remember this, we might have a song here for Tina Turner. That was my, at that point in time, London Beat was not yet an entity. We were just some guys getting together to write songs. And with that in mind, I'm thinking, well, if this is an idea, who could we give it to? London Beat was was just a twinkle in our eye at that point. You know, we were songwriters together at that point. So we together the next night, the next time we met, we pushed this idea into what became the 90% basis of 9 a.m. It's a wonderful story with this song because the strings and everything was an idea that struck from the man who had done the strings for a lot of the Eurythmics material. Here comes the rain again. If you listen to that track and listen to the strings, the man who did the string arrangement for that is the same guy. So all of these little stories make for something very precious for me when it comes to certain of our titles, and 9 a.m. being the precious one for me.
I remember an evening after that massive success, and I think it was Willie M. This is pretty vague because there was a lot of alcohol involved in this night, and a couple of buses.
Yeah,
and I think buses, yeah. Do you remember? Yeah, what there was a London Beat party on two sort of coaches or bus London buses. Yeah, there was two London buses, and I need to sort of explain this a little bit to everyone, but it was organised that we went to different people's homes where a party mm-hmm. was already set up. We would go in, the music would go on, we'd have a little party for, I don't know, half an hour, a klaxon would go off, we'd have to go back on the bus, and then we'd go off. And we ended up also at the Limelight, and the last place we ended up was some Italian restaurant, I think, which had opened kindly for us to serve us all espressos in the early hours. But this was one of the greatest parties I'd been on in my life, because it was such a lot of fun.
Oh, wonderful.
Were you there?
I was there.
Yeah, I can't remember much about it. I'm sorry.
Once again, a tiny bit of backstory about how that idea of doing this bus party thing happened in the first place. We were in, Monte Carlo, somewhere doing a television, and they transported us from our hotel to a place where they were having, you know, the record company was having a party for us in this restaurant. And in this restaurant, we had a great time. We were there any number of times when we were in that neck of the woods. But in this restaurant, the musicians they had these roving musicians who would come around to your table, and we were laughing by the fact because as the music sped up, your eating process got faster and faster. The faster the music got, the faster you ate. So we were throwing these ideas around about what, because if you remember, maybe not because we were drinking so much that night at this party you're speaking of, Sandra Turnbull, Willie M., and I were all Librans. We were born all close around the same point in time in late September, early October. And so we decided we were going to have this party to celebrate our combined birthday, if you will, you know. And a lot of other things at the same time. So I can't remember. I think Willie and Sandra and I collaborated about how we're going to do this thing. And somebody said we could do it on a city bus in London, but how are you going to do that? So it boiled down to two buses stopping at all these places, a shot of tequila or tin in this place, and then maybe a couple more and a beer to top it off. And so we ended up in this Italian restaurant. It was an amazing night. It was an amazing night. We're still talking about it.
It was genius. It really was genius. Another thing that happened as well, I believe I trained, this is inverted commas, all of you as an interview trainer one evening.
You did?
Yeah. I have no idea why, because talking to you today, there was never any reason to be to have to train London. No, you were all such good talkers. You were always such good talkers. But that was another really special occasion. That was at Willie M's flat, wasn't it? I think we went there.
Yep. I think if memory serves, you were doing some things for MTV.
Yeah, that's right. I was presenting on MTV and interviewing people, and they And I think the record company then phoned me up and said, would you like to do some interview training with London Bee? And I was like, yep.
Oh, absolutely. Fantastic.
And it was fantastic.
We Sandra was very good at many things, managerial duties, if you will. But she was very good at spotting what needed to be done, what we needed to look like on stage, how we're going to, ideas for the next video, all of these things, which, quite honestly, as an artist, I had not ventured into. I didn't feel like it was my territory to start doing input for, you see. But Sandra encouraged us to bring our ideas forth and inject our own feelings about this, that, or other aspect of what we were doing as a band. And one of those things was to get on board somebody who could give us some instruction, give us some ideas about how to respond in an interview situation and not waffle. I remember using that. Don't waffle.
I think I said that. I think the thing was, you were a group of four people, and a group is always much more difficult when a question is given to a group. It's easier on a one-to-one interview basis for the person to answer, because then they know they're the one answering. But when it's a group, everyone wants to get their piece in, and it's actually sort of paying respect to each other. Anyhow, I'm not going to give you a lesson again, because this is ridiculous. But what I want to say, it really pleases me that London Beat, or that today, New London Beat, which is without Willie M today, and you are still performing, and you're out there, and you're still singing. Can you tell me how it is for you today to be still, and if I can say it, you know, you're over 80 and you're performing on stage, and you have a wonderful energy and charisma and power still today. I mean, you always it, but you really have it today, and that pleases me so immensely. So how is it for you to be out there touring and playing, still playing gigs?
I can sum it up, I think, in a couple of words. At my age, I get up every day, every morning, I go to bed at night, and the first thing I hear in the morning and the last thing I hear at night is the old man knocking at the door. I've worked out the way that I ain't gonna let him in. Okay? Boom. And once I've made that conclusion, the rest, it simplifies the process. If you make that decision that, you get older, but you don't have to get old, you know, you age, but you don't have to, I'm not ready for the walking stick quite yet. So when it happens, I'll embrace that part of my life. But for now, the energy is still good. I think the blessing is, as I look around at the period in time that we had our success with London Beat, and I look at other artists that I can compare our, not necessarily the level of success, I'm not talking about that, I'm talking about how you are perceived as time has gone on, how your music has stood or not stood the test of time. And one thing that stands out for me as an example is I was looking, I'm an avid news reader, and especially in the music scene. After all of these years, Rolling Stone magazine, you know, Rolling Stone, has decided this year that Marvin Gaye should be in the top five of most important singers of our time, of our generation and preceding generation, etc. So for that to happen now, how long has Marvin Gaye not been with us? And you look at that, and I look at it myself, and I say, there's a perception here of this music is being perceived now to have elevated itself from the time when it was originally recorded and performed. Marvin Gaye has been gone a long time, but his stature in the music business has elevated itself in a way that makes me think, yeah, there's something about longevity that is a blessing. And for as long as I can embrace that, keeping the old man outside the door, I'm going to do it. I'm going to keep doing it, Steve.
Brilliant. Well, I hope that longevity goes for a very, very long time, because one thing I want to say to you is that I really appreciate your talent and your voice and how it's enriched our culture and enriched my life. And it is an absolutely beautiful, beautiful voice. So, Jimmy Helms, thank you from the bottom of my heart. It was so lovely to see you again. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. And as they say, it ain't over till the fat lady sings. And I ain't hearing her sing yet. So there's more music coming. And fingers crossed, when it's ready, I'll squirt something across to you and see what you think of it. But it's been an absolute joy speaking to you. And all the wonderful golden memories of those times are flooding back. But let's push it on and see what happens in the future.
Great, Jimmy. And I'm going to come and see you in concert whenever I've got the opportunity. So thank you, and I'll see you again. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
What a life. Wonderful. That's it for now. Look out for more interviews on Pop, The History Makers.
We made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
"It's time to switch.
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply."
Right now at Safeway, save on all your favorite home scents and cleaning products for a fresh, clean home. Shop for deals on items like Glade candles and plug-ins, Febreze air fresheners, Clorox cleaners, Swiffer wet cloths, or Scotch-Brite sponges. Plus, deck the halls and shop for deals on items like mini light sets, holiday wrapping paper, holiday candles, and holiday cards. Offer expires December 26th. Restrictions apply. Promotions may vary. Visit Safeway.com for full offer details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.